Save big during Labor Day at Lowe's. Get up to 40% off select major appliances. Plus, buy more to get up to an additional 20% off. Shop even more savings with 3 Stay Green 1 cubic foot vegetable and flower garden soil bags for $10. This Labor Day, take care of your home for less at Lowe's. We help. You save. Valid through 9/3. Soil offer excludes Alaska and Hawaii. Selection varies by location. Select locations only. While supplies last. See Lowe's.com for more details.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Lowe's knows that no matter your paint project, saving is at the top of your list. That's why when you shop today, you can buy one, get one free select Valspar and HGTV Home by Sherwin-Williams one coat coverage interior paints via rebate. Shop these deals in-store or online today at Lowe's. We help, you save. Selection varies by location. While supplies last. Discount taken at time of purchase. See sales associate for details. Offer valid 8/21 through 9/3.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Labor Day Sale and get 35% off paints and stains August 22nd through September 4th. With prices starting at $31.84, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
This is a True Crime in Real Time update from True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers podcast.
It took 6 months for anyone to notice. 6 months where no one saw them, no one heard from them, no one knocked on the door hard enough to realize an entire family had vanished. And when someone finally did, what they found inside wasn't just a crime scene, it was a tomb. December 31st, 2024. A day meant for celebrations, for fresh starts. But for the Vossler family, it was the day the world finally caught up to the horror inside their home. Deputies had been there before, 3 times, knocking, checking, waiting. No answer. No sign of forced entry. And without that, there was no legal reason to break the door down. So they left. Over and over again, they left. But this time was different. This time, it wasn't just concerned neighbors making the call, it was family. 2 of William and Eileen Vossler's sons had finally had enough. No calls returned, no sign of life, no way in. So they did something desperate. They climbed onto the roof, pulled an air conditioning unit from the second story window, and climbed inside. It took less than a minute for them to realize something was very, very wrong. The smell was the first thing that hit them, thick and unmistakable. And then they saw her. Subin Lee, their brother's girlfriend, sprawled on the bed, unmoving. They didn't look any further. They didn't have to. They scrambled back out of the house, yelling for the deputies to get inside now. What those officers walked into was something out of a horror movie. The air was heavy, stale, the kind of silence that only comes from a house that's been holding its breath for too long. Room by room, they moved through the mess, following the stench of decay, the weight of something unnatural pressing in from all sides. Then they reached the bathroom. The door was locked. They forced it open, and there was Shane Vossler, the youngest son, slumped over in a way that made it clear there was no coming back. A gunshot wound to the head. A gun beside him. He had been there for days, maybe longer. But that wasn't the worst of it. In the garage, there was a chest freezer. At first glance, nothing seemed unusual. But then they saw the note taped to the front. Handwritten. Careful. Like someone wanted to make sure no detail was forgotten. Time of death, July 24th, 5:45 a.m. And another. Time of death, July 24th, 3 p.m. Inside, buried beneath layers of plastic, were William and Eileen Vossler, missing for 6 months. Murdered. Stuffed away like they were nothing more than an afterthought. The autopsy report confirmed what the crime scene had already suggested. William, 68 years old, stabbed in the chest, beaten over the head. Eileen, 66, stabbed multiple times in the chest and neck. There was nothing accidental about their deaths. This was violent, personal. And it had happened months ago. Soobin Lee, 34, had been shot in the head. The medical examiner couldn't say for sure if it was suicide or if someone else had pulled the trigger. And then there was Shane, 33, dead from a self-inflicted gunshot wound, the last one standing. So here's the reality of what went down inside that house. William and Eileen were killed on July 24th. The timestamps made that clear. Their bodies were hidden, packed away in a freezer, while Shane and Sue continued living in that house like nothing had happened. Day after day, for 6 months, they went about their lives. They took in deliveries, checked the mail, played video games. And outside, life kept moving. No one questioned why William wasn't out in the driveway fixing cars like he always did. No one knocked hard enough to hear what was really going on inside. It wasn't until bills stopped being paid and William's truck was repossessed that people started asking questions. Neighbors noticed the house had gone quiet. William's other sons started wondering why they couldn't get a hold of their parents. And then came the welfare checks. Three of them. December 23rd, December 29th, December 30th. Each time, deputies knocked, listened, waited. And each time, when no one answered, they left. Because legally, that's all they could do. It took family breaking in themselves for the truth to finally come out. But the truth wasn't just about the discovery. It was about the months leading up to it. It was about the cover-up. The eerie, impossible way life just kept moving forward inside a house filled with death. And it was about the questions that detectives had to untangle in the aftermath. Did Shane kill his parents alone, or was Sue involved? Was this planned, or did something snap? Why didn't they run? Why didn't they leave? And the biggest question of all, how does someone live for 6 months in a house with the bodies of their own parents hidden in the garage freezer? Finding the answers to that means understanding who Shane and Sue were, what their lives looked like before all of this, and how everything led to that final moment, when the last person alive in that house decided it was time to pull the trigger. For the Vosslers, life had always been quiet. Not the kind of quiet that comes from peace, but the kind that comes from keeping to yourself, from living in a bubble where the outside world rarely intrudes. Their home in Puyallup wasn't a place filled with visitors or family gatherings. It wasn't a house where neighbors stopped by for coffee or where friends came and went. It was a closed-off world, and for years, that was just the way they lived. William and Eileen Vosler weren't the kind of people who made waves. He spent his time working on cars in the driveway, keeping to himself, fixing what needed fixing. She stayed inside, handling the house, content to live a life without much outside interference. Their children were grown, with the exception of Shane, who, well into his 30s, was still living at home. And while some parents might push their adult children to get out into the world to start their own lives, it seemed like the Vosslers had simply adjusted to the arrangement. Or at least they had tolerated it. Shane had never been particularly social. He wasn't the type to make friends easily, wasn't the guy people remembered from school, or the one who stood out in a crowd. He lived most of his life online, immersed in gaming, forming relationships in digital spaces where he didn't have to navigate the awkwardness of the real world. That's where he met Soobin Lee. Sue was a world away when they first connected. They bonded over gaming, over long conversations through headsets, over the kind of interactions that feel meaningful in the moment but don't require the same kind of effort as in-person relationships. Eventually, those conversations turned into something more. They spent years talking, growing attached in the way that people do when the internet becomes their reality. And at some point, Sue left wherever she had been and moved in with Shane at his parents' house. That kind of relationship, it works for some people, but for Shane and Sue, it wasn't just companionship. It was insulation. A way to build a world where neither of them had to face anything beyond their own carefully constructed space. They didn't go out much. They didn't have a social life outside of each other. They were a unit, separate from everything else, reinforcing each other's views, whatever those might have been. For years, that's how it was. Shane, Sue, and his parents, all under the same roof, all existing in a way that didn't require much engagement with the outside world. No one knows if tensions ever rose over that arrangement. If William and Eileen ever pushed Shane to be more independent, to make something of himself, to leave the nest. But what's clear is that by 2024, cracks were beginning to form. The family's financial situation wasn't stable. William's truck was repossessed. A small detail, but one that suggested bills were going unpaid. Did that put pressure on the household? Did arguments break out over money, over responsibility, over who was pulling their weight and who wasn't? There's no record of any loud fights, no police reports of disturbances. But money has a way of straining even the quietest families. Whatever was happening inside those walls, something shifted in November of 2024. That was when Sue posted online that she was thinking about suicide. And not just any suicide, she was contemplating it with Shane. That kind of statement isn't one people make lightly. It's a red flag so bright, it should have been impossible to miss. But the problem with online cries for help is that they often go unheard. Or worse, ignored. Maybe people saw it and thought it was just talk. Maybe they assumed someone closer to her would intervene. Maybe it didn't even seem real. Hindsight makes it easy to say someone should have done something. But at the time, Sue and Shane were already so removed from the world that even their distress signals barely reached the surface. They had isolated themselves to the point where no one was paying close enough attention. And then, in December, the welfare checks started. Three times deputies came to the house, three times they knocked, three times they walked away when no one answered. Legally, that's all they could do. They had no way of knowing that inside that house, the only people left were long past saving. In the end, the crime itself wasn't the only disturbing part of this story. It was everything that led up to it. The slow descent into isolation, the warning signs that were either missed or ignored, the way two people bound together in their own world could spiral so completely that murder and suicide became their only way out. Investigators later tried to piece together how it had gotten to that point. Some experts suggested something called folie à deux, a shared psychotic disorder where two people feed into each other's delusions, reinforcing each other's worst thoughts. Was that what happened here? Did Shane and Sue spiral together, convincing each other that this was the only path left? And what about Sue's role in all of this? Was she just an observer, watching things unfold, too dependent on Shane to leave? Or was she a participant? Did she help? Did she encourage it? By the time authorities arrived, it was too late to ask those questions. All they could do was look at the evidence and try to make sense of a reality that, to most people, made no sense at all. But what was clear, what was undeniable, was that by the time December rolled around, there was no coming back. They had lived with the consequences of their choices for 6 months. And in the end, the only thing left for them to do was die. There would be no trial, no courtroom drama, no cross-examinations, no final statements, no chance for a jury to sit and listen to the gruesome details, no verdict to be read, no sentencing. The case, as horrific as it was, ended the moment Shane Vosler pulled the trigger. What was left wasn't justice, but simply an official statement. Double homicide, double suicide. Case closed. For the Pierce County Sheriff's Office, the work was largely procedural after that. The forensic reports were finalized, the case files were wrapped up. There would be no suspects to track down, no legal battles to fight. But that didn't mean there weren't questions about the investigation, about the months of silence, about whether anything could have changed the outcome before it was too late. One of the biggest criticisms came almost immediately, the welfare checks. Three times deputies had come to the house, knocked on the door, listened, and left. Three times, they'd walked away without forcing entry. Some people, especially those online, dissecting every part of the case, pointed to that as law enforcement's biggest failure. They could have gone inside sooner. They could have discovered the bodies before Shane had the chance to end his own life. They could have stopped this before it unraveled into something out of a horror story. But from the sheriff's department's perspective, their hands were tied. Legally, they couldn't just break down a door because a family wasn't answering. There were no signs of a struggle. No reports of domestic violence, no cries for help, no broken windows, no visible evidence of a crime. Just silence. And silence, by itself, isn't enough to justify kicking in a door. Deputies defended their handling of the situation, explaining that without probable cause, they were limited in what they could do. One officer later stated, "If we had broken in without any legal reason, we'd have had a lawsuit on our hands." That's the ugly reality of law enforcement. When they act too soon, they get blamed for overreach. When they wait too long, they get blamed for inaction. In this case, they stuck to the rulebook, and by the time the rulebook allowed them in, it was already over. That led to another debate. Should welfare check laws be more flexible? Should law enforcement have the power to force entry into a home when someone has been unresponsive for weeks or months, even if there's no clear evidence of danger? Some argued that in situations like this, where an entire family had seemingly disappeared, deputies should have been allowed to investigate more aggressively. Others pointed out the slippery slope, that if police could enter any home just because someone hadn't been seen in a while, it would open the door to serious civil rights concerns. For the Vossler's surviving sons, none of that mattered. No amount of legal justification could undo what they had walked into that day. No technicalities could soften the horrific betrayal of knowing their own brother had murdered their parents and lived with the bodies for half a year. They had been the ones to make the final, gruesome discovery. And now, they were left to piece together the wreckage. The house, once a place of quiet routine, was now infamous. It was impossible to go back to normal when normal had been shattered beyond recognition. The property would eventually be emptied, cleaned, and likely put up for sale. But even if new owners moved in, the ghost of what had happened there would always linger. For the neighbors, the realization hit like a gut punch. They had lived next door to this and had no idea. They had walked past the house, mowed their lawns, chatted on their porches, all while two bodies were hidden in a freezer and two more were waiting for their turn. The people who had once waved to William as he worked on his cars now had to grapple with the fact that they had completely missed the signs. One neighbor later admitted, "We just assumed they were out of town. We didn't think anything of it." Another said, "Looking back, yeah, it was weird that William just stopped coming outside. But you don't think to yourself, maybe he's in a freezer in the garage. You just assume he's busy or sick or something normal." Some wondered whether Sue's social media post about contemplating suicide should have been taken more seriously. She had written it in November, weeks before the final discovery. Could someone have stepped in then? Could a family member, a friend, even a stranger who saw the post have done something? Or was it already too late by that point? The case didn't just shock the local community, it blew up on a national scale. True crime forums lit up with theories. Podcasts dissected the details. YouTube channels posted timelines. Reddit threads filled with speculation. People couldn't wrap their heads around it. Not just the killings, but the six-month cover-up. Some saw it as a suicide pact that spiraled out of control. Others thought it was a murder-suicide from the start. That Shane had planned it all, killed his parents, and kept the bodies hidden until he was ready to go out on his own terms. A few even pushed darker theories, wondering if there had been some kind of ritualistic element, though investigators found no evidence of anything beyond cold, calculated homicide. Psychologists weighed in on the mental unraveling that must have happened in that house. How could two people live with such a secret for so long? How does a person walk past the freezer holding their murdered parents every day and just keep going? Experts pointed to extreme dependency, a psychological state where people isolate themselves to the point where they lose all perspective. When you're completely cut off from the outside world, your reality starts to shrink. Things that would horrify most people start to seem normal. And that was the biggest takeaway for a lot of experts. Shane and Sue had built a world where this made sense to them. It might not have made sense to anyone else, but in their twisted little bubble, they had rationalized every step. The isolation, the detachment, the feeling that they had nowhere else to go, it had all pushed them to this. What made the case so disturbing wasn't just the violence. It was the slow, creeping nature of it. This wasn't a crime of passion. It wasn't an impulsive decision. It was drawn out, planned, endured. Shane and Sue had been living with the consequences of their actions for months. And instead of running, instead of leaving, instead of trying to start over, they had stayed. That's what stuck with people the most. The realization that something like this could be happening behind any closed door. That a house, a family, a seemingly ordinary life could be masking something unthinkable, And when it was all over, there were no lessons learned, no justice served. Just four bodies, a sealed crime file, and a lingering question that no one could truly answer. How do you stop something like this before it's too late?
He was charming, handsome, a devoted husband, a doting father. When his wife died tragically in a freak accident, everyone pitied him. He played the role so well, grieving widower, devastated, single dad, just trying to put the pieces back together. But the thing about perfect men, they're usually hiding something. And this one was hiding everything. The affair, the insurance policy, the other wife in another state who had no idea she was married to a walking crime scene. If she had only subscribed to True Crime Today, Premium Plus on Apple Podcasts, she could have listened to Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi ad-free. And before everyone else, she could have seen through the lies. She could have gotten out while she still had the chance. Instead, she's just another case we'll be covering next week. Don't be her. Subscribe now to True Crime Today Premium Plus on Apple Podcasts.
There's a lot of pressure to wear the right clothes for every situation, but the clothes don't make the man. With Mack Weldon, you can build a wardrobe that looks polished in any setting and tells the world you stay you wherever you go. Go to MackWeldon.com and get 25% off your first order of $125 or more with promo code MACK25. That's MACKWELDON.com. Promo code MACK25.
Chances are you've been to the doctor recently and you probably handed over your insurance, your ID, and even your social security number. Your doctor is just one of many places that has your personal info. And if any of them accidentally expose your details, you could be at risk for identity theft. LifeLock monitors millions of data points a second. If you become a victim, they'll fix it, guaranteed, or your money back. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.